Hey everyone, happy New Year's. Hope you guys had really good holidays. We're back with part three of our interview with philosopher Ken Wilber. He's the creator of integral theory and one of the key figures in the area of consciousness studies in our time. In this episode, we talk about useful practices for waking up, growing up, cleaning up, and showing up for life. You can find all the links and show notes for this part at futurethinkers.org/113. To check out previous parts, go to futurethinkers.org/112. Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start. I wanted to ask you about practice. So it seems that these kinds of cultural transitions, there's often something in the zeitgeist that kind of pushes people to move to the next stage. But given all the trouble we're experiencing in the world with these super intelligent technologies, like, you know, it could go terribly wrong or terribly right. And with climate change, likewise, you know, it could go terribly wrong, or maybe we'll be able to survive through it fine. So with granted all of these challenges, what kind of practices do you think are the most useful to help ferry people over from first tier to second tier?
Right. Well, let me just give some actual types of practice that an individual can do right now. And I'll give some from that can help with growing up and some that can help with waking up. And then I'll very, very briefly talk about cleaning up, because it's a really important area that most people need a lot of work on. And I'll go ahead and start with cleaning up. Cleaning up is also an area that really was only discovered about 100 years ago. So it's still much too recent to be included in any of the world's great spiritual systems. So it's just another area of integral that we have to add to any sort of practice of waking up in order to cover all the bases, because we keep learning things on a daily basis. Cleaning up has to do with what's generally called shadow material, or just unconscious repressed material. And of course, we often associate that particular practice with the name Sigmund Freud. And Freud's inner circle when he started included Carl Jung and Alfred Adler and Otto Rank. And it really was a fairly major sort of discovery on the part of humans. And Freud only wrote his first book in 1895. So again, it's only about 100 years ago that this happened. But one of the things that we found out is that people can actually take aspects of their own awareness, their own mind, their own psyche, and they can judge them harshly and shove them out of awareness. And when you do that, they become unconscious. They become part of your shadow material. And very, very few people escape childhood without some sort of significant shadow material. And we find this in world leaders. We find it, people will often take up a spiritual practice because they have shadow material that's just driving them in really insane ways. And one of the most common things that happens, one of the most common defense mechanisms, is you have some element of you that for whatever reason you really don't like. And it could be because your parents didn't like it, or your peers didn't like it, or you just decided that you thought that was a horrible thing to have. And so instead of working on it, you just denied it. You just disowned it. So let's say you're really over-controlling, and that's just a trait that you have. And you sort of shove that out, and that really hyper-controlling aspect of you becomes a part of your shadow. And then one of the most common things people do with shadow elements is they project them onto other people. So you're sitting there, and you know that somebody is feeling really controlling right now, but it's not you, so it must be your boss. So you project that controlling element of yourself onto your boss. Now, your boss might already be fairly controlling, but now he's got two control elements. He's got his and he's got yours. So now he appears like this massively controlling, like he's looking over your shoulder all the time. You start getting reactive. Maybe you snap back at him and you're sort of heading along a path where you're very likely going to get fired if you keep something like that up. People do this all the time. If they have a particular drive that they want to really complete a particular task, like a man is out raking the yard or something like that, and he's really getting tired of it. And so he's starting to lose track of his own desire to get this done. And his wife sticks her head out the door and says, finish those leaves. And he explodes at her because he thinks she's now just pushing him. She's the one that's forcing him to clean the leaves up. And he just explodes at her and yells. Or you can have a sexual impulse. The ones that Freud examined, sex and aggression. So you can have a sexual impulse with somebody. Push that out and then think they're trying to hit on you all the time. You can push anger out of your awareness. Think the entire world is mad at you. You'll often then get clinically depressed if something like that happens. So all of these are, you're getting these symptoms that seem real and just caused by themselves, but they're really caused by your shadow material. And one of the most difficult things as people learn about shadow material is it does tend to mean that those things that you really react to in the environment, that you really hate, really can't stand, those are in many, many cases, at least in some degree, at your own shadow elements. It means you have to admit that, no, wait, you're that person that has all that anger, or you're that person that has all that pride, or you're the person that's over-controlling. And it's a very humbling, in some ways, quite difficult practice to do. But it also is the source of most of the kind of interpersonal problems that you're having. And so if you were to go to a therapist or something like that, you would end up working on something like that. So one of the things that you can do to help with this whole process that we call cleaning up or reintegrating your shadow elements is simply looking for the people or the things that really, really move you hugely. And it can be, by the way, in a positive or negative way. People can and often do project their positive qualities, and then they end up hyper here making heroes out of people, or just admiring them all off the wall. And they just, oh, you're so great, you're wonderful. And they just lost track of a little bit of their own greatness, their own specialness. People do that all the time and end up projecting that onto other people. So they take a first-person impulse or quality, they shove it out of awareness into a second person, a you or they or them. And then if that's not enough, they'll shove it all the way into a third person. Oh, it just belongs to him or her, all of them. They're all angry at me for I don't know why. And so the cleaning up process is reversing that. You take, let's say you have a dream and you're projecting your anger and it's showing up in the dream as a monster who's trying to eat you. And you're having this recurring dream and you wake up, it's a nightmare, and you wake up almost every night with this horrible dream. So if that's some of your real shadow material, then you want to just reverse the steps that created it. And we, in the sense that it was created by going from first person to second person into third person, now it's just showing up as a monster in your dreams. Then reversing that means take it from a third person, make it a second person, and then make that first person. So in this case, and you often just use what Gestalt therapy calls an empty chair. So you just sit down and you have an empty chair in front of you and you put the monster in that chair. So you're taking that third person monster and you're making them a second person sitting right in the chair across from you. And you start talking to it. Why are you here? Why are you doing this? And you ask it a question and then you play the monster and answer. And you go back, ask it another question, then play the monster and answer. And after doing that, until you actually start to feel like, okay, I'm the monster answering, then you make it first person. You actually identify with that monster. One of the things you'll find out as you ask what are you doing, monster? Why are you here? What are you doing? The monster will say things like, I want to eat you. I want to rip you up. I hate your guts. I'm angry at you. So it's got this enormous amount of anger and aggression. It's aimed at you. And that's why you don't feel aggression. You just feel fear, because that's what the shadow is leading. And so as you've been going back and you've been identifying with that monster, you start to get in touch with that anger that you weren't allowing yourself to get in touch with. So you're re-owning it. You're taking it back. And then when you finally make it first person, you've re-owned it. And if that was the cause of the monster showing up, the monster will stop showing up in your dream. And the same if you projected some of your greatness or your ability onto somebody else, and you put them in the empty chair, start talking back and forth, start identifying with them, and then re-own that quality, then you'll get in touch again with that part of you that's very, very special and that you've just lost track of and projected. That turns out to be a really enormous part of people's lives. They project either positives or negatives onto others. And it's particularly common, of course, in relationships. And many relationships that don't have access to some sort of actual practice of cleaning up or some sort of therapeutic practice, those relationships work only if the shadow elements of both people match up well. So if one person projects their controlling nature onto their partner, and then the partner projects their greatness onto their partner, then they'll just go back, oh, you're wonderful. Oh, you do it, therefore do whatever I say. So the person will do whatever they say. Then, oh, you're so wonderful. Oh, and they just fit, and they just love it. And they never have to confront their shadows, and things go just wonderfully from that time on. But this has been a new addition to human knowledge. Again, only about 100 years old. That was right about the same time that James Mark Baldwin was discovering the stages of growing up. And by the way, Baldwin was a colleague with William James. And they're often, if you say, who is America's greatest psychologist, these two often, it's one or the other of them. But they were friends. And while Baldwin was discovering growing up, William James was writing a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience. He was studying waking up experiences, his first person experiences of metamorphosis or satori or spiritual experiences. And that's what he was doing. So this is some really incredibly important periods in human discovery about aspects of themselves that they really had no idea was there before. And so when you get to waking up, so practices you can do for cleaning up, and just look for those people or things around you that especially charge you up, either positively or negatively. And then think about a little 3-2-1 re-owning some of those shadow elements. For waking up, there are two main phases of this sort of all-inclusive unity experience. And the first is that, and this is a simple practice, in the mystical traditions, it's often called, in Sanskrit, it's called neti neti. And that literally means not this, not that. And so it's the way you discover your true self. And your true self, if I was to say to you, just make a list of all the things, all the qualities that describe you or define you. And so you start writing out, my name is such and such. I'm this many years old. I was born in such and such a place. I went to school here. I have this degree. I work in this job. I'm in this relationship. And you just sort of list all these things that you can think about yourself. And then a tradition, something like Zen Buddhism or Vedanta or Christian mysticism, would say, okay, that's fine. But notice you have at least two selves. One is the self that you can see, that can be seen. And that's everything that you just wrote down. But then there's the seer of that. There's the witness of all of that. And you can't see that as an object. If you look within, anything you can see is by definition part of the seen self. You can't see the seer. And so many of the traditions will simply say that the seer itself is a vast emptiness. It's a vast openness. But whatever you do, you can't qualify it. You can't put an adjective on it. Because if you do, you're just making it objective. You're making it part of the seen self. And that's not who you are, not really. And that's why most of the traditions maintain that who we think we are is an illusion. It's we've identified with some set of objects. And they're not even a real subject. They're not even a real self that's doing the seeing. They're just something that can be seen. They're all objects. That's not who you are. So everything you wrote down on that sheet of paper, that's who you are not. That's not your real self. Now, as you meditate, and it's you're doing zazen, and you're just sitting in a corner for 4 hours a day and not moving, what's going to happen is all this objective crap is going to come up, and you're going to just see it, and you're going to see it, and you're going to see it. And as you see something, you're disidentifying with it. Whether you know it or not, that's what's happening. You say, oh, I see that. Okay, that's an object. That's not the witness. I'm just the witness. And as you just sit there witnessing everything, then sooner or later, you just fall into that radical witnessing stance. And that, to the extent that's described at all, is described as a radical freedom, a radical liberation, a genuine nirvana, because you're not identified with any of these manifest finite objects. And all objects do the same thing. They come, they stay a while, they torture you, and they leave. That's all objects do. And you're actually identified with a bunch of those. That's stupid. That's called an illusion. That's the big illusion. And so what these traditions want you to do is find your real self. What's the actual self, capital S? What's the seer of all of this? Not something seen. What's the seer? So the practice on that aspect of the waking up, it's just, I'm not this, I'm not that. Anything you can see is not who you really are. And that can become a very, very profound realization. And it's sometimes described as just pure awareness and not any content of awareness. And that's what it is. It's just this pure consciousness, pure awareness, pure being. But the thing is, because it's not identified with any of these objects out there, then you're free of that. So I see the mountain, I'm not the mountain. I see this computer screen, I'm not this screen. I have sensations, I'm not those sensations. I have feelings, I'm not those feelings. I have thoughts, I'm not those thoughts. I'm the witness of all of that. And the witness is free of all of that. It's free from these sensations, from these feelings, from these thoughts, free from this body, free from this mind. That's a radical freedom. And that radical freedom, the discovery of that part of that radical freedom, is the beginning of what's called enlightenment or awakening or realization. And it's just that. So I'm not this, I'm not that. And you can start to get a sense of the freedom that pure awareness has. And that can be just even getting a little glimmer of just that pure witnessing awareness. It's not any content. Anything you can see is not it. So what's left is this vast, vast openness, this vast clearing in which everything is arising moment to moment. But you're none of what's arising. You're just this vast open, this vast clearing, this radical freedom. So that's a good one to begin waking up. And then a good practice for growing up. Let me give you a quick example. And this is also why growing up wasn't discovered until just so recently. But this is, it's called a two-colored ball experiment. And it's really rather famous. It's a version of which Piaget did. But if you take a very young child, say 2 or 3 years old, and you take a ball that's colored differently on both sides. So let's say one side of it is green, one side of it is red. And you put the child here, and then you're here, and then you put the ball between the two of you, and you turn it a lot of times so they can see it's green on this side, it's red on this side, it's green on this side, red on this side. And then you turn, and then you put it so the red side is facing the child, and the green side is facing you. And you ask the child, what color are you seeing? They'll correctly say red. They say, what color am I seeing? They'll say red. They can't do what psychologists call, they can't take the role of other. They cannot see it through your eyes and realize that you're seeing the world in an entirely different way. But as they get older, and certainly by the time they're 6, 7 years old, if you do that same thing, say, what color are you seeing? They'll say red. Say, what color am I seeing? They'll say green. They get it right. They can actually, they understand that you're seeing the world through a different perspective. Now, that's actually shifting from early stages of growing up that are often called egocentric into those group-oriented where you take the role of other, and we're going to call it ethnocentric, on the way to world-centric. So part of, and you can see that the difficulty right there is that this is often something that just wasn't particularly noticed because, you know, the child's just being a child and whether they can tell what you're seeing or not, it's not something they normally ask a child. And certainly no human researchers did until about 100 years ago when they discovered this kind of stuff. But that also turns out to be because each new major stage of growing up adds a capacity for yet another perspective. So you actually end up going from first-person perspective to second-person perspective to third-person to fourth-person and so on. And we have empirical evidence going all the way up to around seventh-person perspective. And even fifth-person, fourth-person, fifth-person can start to sound like super, super complicated. But if we say something like, do you think that when Mary said that she didn't like Bobby being in love with me, do you remember what she said? Even something like that can involve a fourth person perspective. And second tier starts to involve fifth person. And as I said, we have empirical evidence up to seventh person. So one of the ways that you can actually help your own growing up process is, and by the way, growing up refers to your conventional self. It's not your true self. The true self doesn't change. It's a pure witness at whatever stage you're at. And you can have a waking up experience at virtually any stage you're at. You'll interpret it according to your stage of growing up because that's how your mind works. So that's why it's important to include both of those. But it's still one of the reasons that the great paths of liberation, the great meditative contemplative paths worldwide, one of the reasons they didn't study stages of growing up is that those were stages that just the relative self goes through. And that's correct. But that relative self is learning to take the perspectives of other, for example. And so that ends up being incredibly important, particularly, as I said, because that's actually how you'll end up interpreting any enlightenment or awakening you had. That's why cultures could have waking up and still have slavery. Slavery you got rid of when you reached a world-centric stage of growing up. Didn't have anything to do with waking up. So what you want to simply do to help take these different perspectives of the relative world is just put yourself in the role of other. Actually sort of imagine that you have this two-colored ball between you and whoever you're talking to. And then at some point, actually put yourself in the role of the other person and try to see what they're seeing. Literally take the role of other. And most of us will tend to do that in a fairly subconscious way. But you can do it as an actual exercise, and it really will exercise that muscle in your brain. And that is one of the very best things you can do for growing up. So you want to take the role of other. You want to, I'm not this, I'm not that. And you want to do a 3-2-1 process about, oh, I hate that person for that. Oh, maybe that's me I'm having trouble with. I'll look into that on the side. One of the things that would just help humanity at large is when, of course, we actually start teaching more overall integral approaches in our schooling system. And I happen to believe that when we do hit about 10% of the population at integral second tier stages, that there will be that tipping point and we will start to, that we'll start to have a major impact on our culture at large. And I think at that point, we can reasonably expect to see more than just 70% of the world's population at ethnocentric or lower. We can start to see more people at orange or green or teal or turquoise second tier, because we'll know it's there. And we will have educated adults that they can continue their education. That when they graduate high school or graduate college, that doesn't mean they stop growing. That's a horrible thing to teach people, but that's basically what we teach people today. And that's a disaster. And it impacts every major world problem that we have.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.
Well, we went through some of the practices in growing up and waking up.
And cleaning up. So what about showing up?
Oh, okay. Well, showing up is they, even though they turn out to be unbelievably present and common almost everywhere, there are very few people actually recognize them, know they're there, and know to look for them. I started writing one of the most major books that I've done called Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. And I started writing that book, and I realized that there was something that was just off. And I was looking at these growth hierarchies. And for some reason, there was an enormous number of them. They seemed in some very vague sense to be covering the same basic levels or stages, waves of development, but not exactly. And they did seem to be somehow, there were some major differences between them. And I couldn't figure out exactly what they were. So even to give some simple examples, we've talked about Gebser's simple stages of archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic to integral. Those are a series of growing up stages. But then you can also just look at evolution itself, and that goes from, again, subatomic particles to atoms, and atoms to molecules, molecules to cells, cells to organisms, organisms in more complex and differentiated fashion. And these are both clearly hierarchies. They're evolutionary hierarchies, growth hierarchies. Each stage transcends and includes its predecessor. So they have certain similarities, but they don't just match up level to level. Something is going on here, and they just weren't fitting together right. So I started taking all of the hierarchies that I was aware of, and I would write one hierarchy on, you know, those big yellow legal pads. I would just write one hierarchy on each yellow pad, and I'd tear the sheet out, put it on the floor, and then write another one on, tear it up, put it on the floor. And I had over 100 sheets of paper lying all over the floor with all of these growth hierarchies, all of them. And they literally covered the floor and most of the house. And what I would do each day is just get up and walk through and look at all of those and go, you know, what is going on here? At one point, I remembered that a lot of the world's metaphysical or mystical philosophers maintain that a universe came into being when subject and object were divided. And they especially meant subject is mind and object is matter, but they would say that it's subject and object. That's what they were really talking about. And so I looked at all these hierarchies I had, and indeed, I'll say about half, I don't know exactly how much it was, but roughly half of them were hierarchies that applied to the subjective domain. And the other half really did apply to an objective domain. So Gebser's stages, those apply to subjective worldviews. They're actually what happens in us, magic to mythic to rational, pluralistic, and so on. And that atoms to molecules to cells, that's happening in an objective realm. So we have all of these subjective growth hierarchies and all these objective growth hierarchies. And so I divided them that way. And that made a lot of sense, and it worked out well. Again, about half were one, half were the other. But there were still some differences, and I couldn't quite figure out. And so another month or two staring at all of these yellow pads all over the floor, and it just hit me that again, about half of them were applying to individuals, and that could be individual subject or individual object, and the other half were collective. So if you take individual atoms, for example, and you draw those together into a collective, you form a galaxy. And then as atoms, as an individual, hold on, individual entity moves from atoms to molecules, then molecules make much larger chains. And they can actually create sort of mineral and crystal. And if you bring those together in a collective form, you create planets. And so then, okay, so that's from galaxies to planets, atoms to molecules. If you take molecules and create cells and then draw a cell together into a group, that always happens on a planet, and it'll be some sort of biosphere, some sort of ecosphere that will be created as all those cells come together. And then if you draw those cells together into animals, and then animals come together, they'll tend to form something like families, for example. So you had, and then this, the same kind of thing was occurring in the interiors. You could have an individual go through particular stages, and then you could have families and towns, even certainly civilizations, have a general center of gravity that the collective was adapted to. And so putting those together actually gave us four, what we call four quadrants. So you had the individuals on the upper two and the collective on the lower two, and then subjective or interior realities on the left hand and the objective or exterior realities on the right hand. And those turned out to be unbelievably fundamental distinctions that at least this universe has made in its own construction and evolution. And I said these turn out to be very common, because one of the ways to look at them is you're dealing with these interior realities, these subjective dimensions, and then you're dealing with exterior or objective dimension, individual and collective. And so what often happens is that the two exteriors, like atoms, galaxies, molecules, planets, those often just get treated as just one reality because they're all material. They all have exterior. And so if you have like a natural scientist who's a biologist and they're looking at it in this objective exterior way, then they're going to look at a living biological animal as being composed of cells and molecules and atoms and so on. In other words, just exteriors. They're not looking at a biological animal and saying, oh, this has certain subjective impulses and it has certain worldviews and we can measure these in humans and that kind of thing. So those are often fused together, the two right-hand quadrants, and that gives us just three major dimensions. So you find these three major dimensions, or all four, in an enormous number of areas. One of the most common is just the good, the true, and the beautiful. So the beautiful, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Aesthetics is in the interior of an individual awareness. That's where beauty arises. There's no natural scientist that says, oh, this animal is objectively has beauty and this animal objectively does not. So beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Goodness is how you and I treat each other as subject. It's an inner subjective moral or ethical reaction. That's what we call the lower left. That's a subjective collective. It's how an individual subject treats other subjects. It's not how I treat you as an object. That's usually thought of as being not very moral at all. And most people don't want that. And then truth, in this case, good, the true, and the beautiful. True just means objective third person truth. And that's the right hand quadrant. And so you can see, I just said third person. And that's right, because these big three are also first person, second person, third person pronoun. And every major language in the world has first, second, and third person pronouns. First person is the person speaking. That's I or me, that beauty, aesthetic dimension. And then second person is the person being spoken to. So that's you. And an I and a you form a we. So that's ethics, that's morals. And then third person is it, or him, her, or just it or its. So that's what objective science attempts to do. It's not looking for beauty. It's not looking for morals or values. It's looking for objective truth. And so you have the good, the true, and the beautiful. You have first, second, and third person. And it also turns out, of course, that many, many different human disciplines focus on just one of these quadrants. So if you are looking at individual developmental psychology, you're studying the stages that the upper left, the interior of an individual consciousness, the stages that that goes through as it grows and develops. You're not studying objective brain, third person brain structures. You're doing that if you study neurophysiology or brain chemistry or something like that. And notoriously, people who study neurophysiology, brain chemistry, don't believe in subjective stages of development because they don't believe in subjective reality. They just believe objective reality is real. So that's one of the problem, is that you have these four quadrants, and the whole point is that what they really represent is just the division of the universe into subjective and objective and singular and plural. That's it. These two fundamental distinctions create these quadrants. And that's why they're bloody well everywhere. And the only problem is there are almost no human disciplines that include all four of them. So they're looking at just the sort of upper right individual holons, just atoms are real, and that's it. And then systems theorists come along and they go, no, just systems are real. Individual holons aren't real, just the lower right quadrant, collective, exterior, third person, objective system. That's what's real. And that includes all reality. And you go, well, are you including beauty in that? Are you including moral values in that? Are you just including these exterior systems? Oh, well, maybe we're just including exterior systems. We don't think beauty is... Okay. And then you have interiors, and there are some people that think just those are real. Idealists, notoriously, think that just consciousness as a reality is what's ultimately real. And so the whole point about these four different quadrants is it was important to include all of those. And that's what I simply call, it was important to show up for all of these fundamental dimensions of reality, because they're very real, they're very important, and they're all there, they all exist. And so it's been one of the things that I've ended up doing is looking at disciplines in each of these quadrants, and particularly the upper left, as we in the West really became more and more scientific with the Western Enlightenment. The whole notion was that the only thing that was real is something that we could all publicly see, something that really was an objective exterior thing that we could measure or somehow quantify, and that's what was real. And as far as our individual minds, our individual psyches, well, you see, I can't see yours and you can't see mine, so we can't really study that. So psychology stopped being the study of the psyche, and it just became behaviorism. What's real is only what you can actually see a person do. So you can see their behavior. We can all see their behavior. So that's real. But any impulses or ideas or concepts producing that behavior, those are nothing but their behavioral third-person manifestation. And so things like subjective development, developmental psychology, that wasn't included in any form of behaviorism. That wasn't really real. And then we did get people start to say, no, wait a minute. There really is such a thing as moral reality. And by the way, those morals develop. You can actually tell when a person's at different stages of moral development, among other things, by simply how they will answer certain questions. So just to give a very simple, quick example of Lawrence Kohlberg, who was a pioneering genius in the measurement of moral development, he would use just simple questions like, a man is married to a woman who has a terminal illness, and the local pharmacy has a drug that will cure her illness, but the man can't afford it. Does he have the right to steal that medicine? And Kohlberg found that he got three major answers. People would say yes, or they say no, or then another group would also say yes, but for very, very different reasons than the first group. So if you go back to the first group and says, yes, the right man has the right to steal it, and you ask them why, they'll say, well, because I can do anything I want. If I want to go steal the medicine, I'll steal the medicine. By the way, fuck you. Now, this is known as pre-conventional or egocentric stages of development. Carol Gilligan, who's a student of Kohlberg, is calling the selfish stage. The next group says no. And you say, well, why not? And you say, well, stealing is against the law. Society says that's wrong. I couldn't go out and do something like that. It would be illegal. It would be horrible. And so across the board, they say no. Some of these stages are also given names like conformists, because the person can now take the role of other. They can see that there's another perspective, but they end up trapped in that perspective. So they end up identifying with that. And so they end up conforming to whatever they're group once. Kohlberg simply called them conventional because they follow the conventions of society. And then you have this third group that says, yes, you can steal it. The man can steal it. And you say, okay, why? And you say, well, because life is worth more than $28 a bottle. And he has the right to do that. And so they're making their decisions based on universal moral principles that apply across the board and for all people. So they're not just being egocentric about it. And so Kohlberg called that post-conventional. And Gilligan called the conventional stages care stages, because people can actually start caring for people other than themselves. But they just care for their group. So it's a very us versus them kind of morality. And then these highest stages she called universal care, because then the person cares for all human beings, regardless of race, color, sex, gender, ethnicity, or creed. And so that's obviously a very high moral development. But the point is, those stages are real. You can determine those stages. There's a certain sense of way you can measure them by using these qualitative tests and measurements. Now, every major developmental psychologist in the world did something like that. And they ended up studying cognitive development, emotional development, moral development, aesthetic development, verbal development, mathematical development, and so on. Those are all areas that somebody who believes in just the upper right, just the exterior of the individual, doesn't believe any of those are real. And so you've just thrown out the entire sweep of growing up. By the way, you've also thrown out waking up, because that's just another subjective state you're having, and we don't believe that's real. And the problem is, of course, most orthodox natural science believes just in the upper right quadrant, just atoms, just molecules, just cells, a third person, singular, individual, whole on. That's all that's real. None of the other quadrants are real. They don't even believe systems are real. Systems are just a bunch of individual real holons slammed together in a group, and then that's all you have. They're not really real in themselves. And they don't believe in any of the interior or left hand. So that was a big deal. And for me, sex ecology, spirituality, that actually marked the beginning of what students will call Wilbur Four, because that's where I really started including not just these different levels of development, which I had down to a fairly fine understanding, and not just different lines of development that went through those levels, and not just shadow material and clinia, but I started explicitly including all four quadrants in any analysis I did of anything, because all four of them were always there. I mean, there's not a single thing you can point to in the universe that doesn't have all four quadrants. And that includes things like electrons and photons. I mean, it's unbelievable. So if you want to not only grow up and wake up and clean up, but if you want to show up for reality, then make sure you're including these fundamental dimensions of reality. They're very real, they're very present, and they will change how you look at almost anything that you are examining and trying to figure out. And one of the real problems in academia today is not only are many academic disciplines confined to just a few levels of development, using just a few lines of development, they almost always think that only one, maybe two at the most, quadrants are real. All the others aren't real. And so you're going to get it wrong right from the start. I mean, at least in the sense that you're not going to be complete or comprehensive in including those areas that are indeed having a major impact on what you're looking at. So this is, showing up is really important. A lot of people will actually start to get a sense about what something integral looks like when they first see the quadrants, and they see different theorists in each quadrant that we're saying it's real, and they see different types of disciplines in each quadrant and how those are all different. And they'll recognize all of them. They intuitively know all of those are real. And so they'll go, oh, I get it. Now I see what integral's trying to do. So showing up turned out to be, I think, a really important discovery. And in this case, it was a discovery of something that was just lying all over the place anyway. It was just everywhere. But it wasn't getting recognition. It just wasn't getting any sort of attention. So,
who do you think are some of the people who are practicing this the best? Because it's one thing to understand it as a framework and to be able to talk about it intelligently, but it's a whole other thing to actually apply it and to make it work and actually help other people to go through this.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to give a list of names because I would invariably leave some important people out, because the integral framework itself really has become fairly worldwide now. There are a lot of people in a lot of different countries that are at least aware of it. I mean, I've done about 25 books, and they've been translated into up to around 30 foreign languages. That's a lot for fairly academic books. And there are integral institutes either formed or forming now in about 17 or 18 countries. So that's starting to happen a lot. And then, as I had briefly mentioned earlier, we now do have at least around 60 human disciplines that have been reinterpreted using this integral framework. And you can just imagine any discipline and how that would be altered by just even including things like growing up and waking up and cleaning up. Even something like law and conflict resolution. I mean, these things are truly important. And even if you look at something like, let's say, physics, what you do find is we briefly went through some of those higher stages of cognitive development, from systemic to metasystemic to paradigmatic to cross-paradigmatic, and how you relate to modern physics will change at each of those stages of development. So this framework is going to have an impact on your field one way or another. And so that part has been very encouraging. And there, it's very rare, if we talk about something, if a person just even gets a sense of these sort of four quadrants of I, we, it, your first person, second person, third person, and how those fit together. I haven't seen anybody who adopts some aspect of the integral framework, and then later on down the line, they wake up in one morning and go, I don't believe that exists. I've changed my mind on all of that. If they just stop sort of being excited by it, then they'll just sort of, you know, not talk about it or not use it that much. But very, very rarely will people just say, oh, I categorically disagree with that aspect. Again, we're very, very careful that the amount of evidence we include really is, in most cases, just not deniable. I mean, it's an enormous amount of evidence. So people are either excited by it, or if they get tired of it, then they'll just sort of get tired of it. But that's allowed the this approach to really be adopted by a relatively large number of people, certainly for anything that is a fairly sophisticated philosophical school or notion. And that has been making impact into normal academia. There are a very, very large number of textbooks that have been written in some of those 60 different disciplines. It's having an impact on orthodox philosophies. So one of the most widely spread orthodox philosophies in the world is called critical realism. And it was headed by a man named Roy Bhaskar. And Bhaskar found out about integral metatheory, and he started reading it, and he got very, very excited by it. And he started coming to integral conferences and started interacting with other integral scholars. There's been, I think, to date, something like around 6 books published specifically on integral theory and critical realism. So that's actually gotten into mainstream orthodoxy fairly, fairly quickly. It's been adopted by Hollywood for some really strange reason that I don't totally understand. But a large number of directors, producers, and even stars, I mean, people like Sharon Stone, for heaven's sake, know this stuff. It's fairly weird. So that part of it has been great. And again, the major aim, none of those ingredients that I talked about, I didn't invent any of those. I just simply have done a really large sort of worldwide search for any kind of truths that are out there. And whenever I find some that look like they really have a great deal of evidence, but that just aren't getting included, then I'll actually put them in the framework. So we've gone from Wilbur 1 to Wilbur 5, and I just kept, you know, adding these things. And that's ultimately just, that's the way I want the framework to be used. I don't even care if you agree with my version of how I presented something. As long as you're aware of the fact that there is, you know, this growing up sequence, that there is this waking up potential, that there is this cleaning up capacity. As long as people are awakened to those kinds of truths, and ideally start to make room in their own lives for those kinds of truths, but at the very least, just becoming aware of them and maybe starting to keep their eyes open themselves for these things, then that's the main point of my work. And to the degree that that has happened in a relatively, I don't want to even say large, but it's not small either, in a relatively decent size worldwide, then that's the thing that I'm most happy about. And then there are a fair number of very specific individuals that are applying these ideas in very specific areas. So in a lot of places, there are actual groups of doctors that will often call themselves something like Integral Doctor Association or something like that. And they're actually using this framework in medical practice, which really actually changes their medical practice for a lot of very beneficial ways. There's a fair number of businesses are now using this, and there are a fair number of books telling businesses how to do this. A lot of conflict resolution, a lot of psychotherapy. And so this has all been very encouraging. And again, the main reason I'm encouraged by this is people are going to these original areas and finding what these things actually say. And then they're starting to use that in their own practice. So that's, I think, really, really fantastic.
Speaking of the, you know, the businesses and different groups that are actually working to use the integral model, are you aware of any technologies or even social technologies that are being used and implemented and perhaps invented to bring collective intelligence together, group collective intelligences, and mediate the process?
Yeah, it's interesting because relatively recently, I mean, given, you know, the almost 50 years that I've been doing this, but I've gotten a fair number of invitations to speak at really large Silicon Valley conferences. And when I was invited to do the first one, and it was a conference of sort of the 200 of the leading Silicon Valley, leading voices. And so I really thought about exactly what to say and how that would go over. And I had noticed that a fair number of people that were coming to this conference had developed applications that you could download. And you can now get very sophisticated headbands that will help give you a brain EEG readout. And so you can actually track your brain waves using these and a computer app. And they would send out a lot of applications that would help people get into meditative states of awareness. And that's where you're just sitting as this is pure witnessing and you're not reacting to anything that's arising. And those are, of course, that's part of a general waking up phenomena. And what happens with waking up is those are made of states of consciousness. So when you have anything like a waking up experience or a meditative experience or a spiritual experience, you know it. You know that's happening. You can feel it. You're aware of it. So if you have this experience where you're one with the entire universe in love and bliss or something like that, you're completely aware of that. You know that. It's not hidden or anything like that. One of the problems with growing up, and because those are direct, immediate, first-person experiences, then our waking up traditions go back, some of them, several thousand years. Because when we had those experiences, we were aware of it. We knew it. We wrote them down and taught them to other people. All these traditions grew up on how to do that. But growing up is very, very different. Growing up isn't made of first-person states of consciousness. It's made of third-person structures of consciousness. And a structure is much more like, let's say, the rules of grammar. So everybody who's brought up in a particular culture ends up speaking that culture's language fairly accurately. They put subject and verb together accurately. They use adjectives and adverbs more or less correctly. In other words, they're following the rules of grammar of that language fairly accurately. We're following English rules of grammar right now. But none of us can look within and see what those rules are. We can't write them down, even though there's a whole list of those rules. None of us can look within and see those rules of grammar. And most people don't even know they're following those rules of grammar, let alone what they are or write them down. These stages of growing up are just like rules of grammar. When you're at one of those stages, you can look within all you want. You will never see it. You won't have a clue that that's what you're doing. So if you're at archaic or magic, mythic, or rational, or pluralistic, or integral, or just egocentric, ethnocentric, world-centric, you have no bloody idea that you're interpreting every experience you have according to the rules of that structure. And that's actually how you're seeing the world. That's just not in any way obvious. Now, one of the problems with the whole growing up sequence is that we don't yet have any type of brain imaging of what type, functional MRI, positron emission. We can't measure brain activity and tell what stage of growing up a person is. So that's a real problem. Because as I said, you can have a waking up experience, but you'll interpret it according to your stage of growing up, because that's what your mind, your relative mind, that's how it will work. And so part of the difficulty is that, and this was the whole problem with the traditional cultures that had practices of waking up and still had slaves, is that they were having these waking up experiences. But if you, for example, are a fundamentalist Christian and you have this experience of waking up, you experience your own Christ consciousness, then you'll experience being one with everything and sort of one with all sentient beings, for that matter. But if somebody doesn't accept Jesus Christ as their personal savior, then you won't think they can have that kind of experience. They may think they're having that kind of experience, but they're really not. It's actually probably the devil whispering in their ear. You're going to interpret it according to your fundamentalist rules. It's an authentic waking up, so but you can interpret it in ethnocentric ways. And Ram Dass even tells a story of his brother who was institutionalized because he thought that he and only he was Jesus Christ. And Ram Dass was just back from India, where he was, you know, running into people that had waking up experiences all over the place. And he had had several himself. And he met his brother and he said, you could tell immediately that he had had a profound waking up experience. He said, but he was at an egocentric stage of growing up. So he interpreted his waking up as if it applied to him and him only. So he awakened to his Christ consciousness and thought he was Jesus Christ. And nobody else, including Ram Dass, could have that experience. So that job was already taken. It was him. So you can be egocentric or ethnocentric or world-centric or integrated and have a waking up experience, and you'll interpret it according to that stage you're at. So I had used, as I gave that first talk, it's about 45 minutes, to the Silicon Valley crowd, I included that as some examples. And I said, so I just want you all to keep an eye out for when we can actually get to the point where we can start brain imaging these structures of growing up, not just these states of waking up. Because what you're doing right now is you can actually be helping Nazis have a waking up experience and still be Nazis. You're not helping that much when you do that. So what we want to see happen is ways you can write apps to help people grow up in addition to waking up. And I thought, well, maybe that's just too complicated or too esoteric or something. But it wasn't. It turned out to be a big hit. So I was asked to do a second one of those, and I did. It was actually voted the favorite talk of the whole damn conference. So this kind of awareness is starting to permeate Silicon Valley anyway. I do know some individuals that have been working on this. I know a large group that has got it to a point where they call it integral Google, which is that you can do a search, but you can put in parameters, search everything for this stage or search everything for the squadron. So they're working that out and they're working on funding for it right now. And I think they're going to get it. And that would be really extraordinary if people could start doing something like that. So we'll see where that goes.
Okay, so we pause here with Ken Wilber, and next week we'll continue talking about what killing Buddha on the road really means and why someone would want to go through the waking up experience in the first place. You can find all the links and show notes at futurethinkers.org/113 and futurethinkers.org/112. See you next week and Happy New Year.
Enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today. The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.